I see it in other families that I know who go through a medical crisis with tremendous unknowns around it. And honestly, a lot of these situations are situations in which, say 50 years ago, but maybe even 15 years ago, the person might have just died. But we have a medical infrastructure that can prolong this moment of uncertainty. And maybe we call it a moment of hope, but also a moment of great uncertainty. And wow, we have created new limbos. And sometimes we ask people to live there for a very long time. And I don't think that we have an amazing capacity for dialogue around what those limbos feel like, how to exist there, and when staying there is the right thing.
I want you to think about the person you love most in the world. Go ahead, really imagine them. Their laugh, their smile, the way they make you feel. Now I want you to imagine if within a matter of weeks, this person's health and vitality was completely gone. That they don't seem to recognize you. They can't communicate with you. And they will now require 24-hour care. But on top of that, you have no idea what is wrong with them. And neither does anyone else. At only 25 years old, Sonia Vallab's life took an unexpected turn with the swift and relentless progression of her beloved mother's illness, eventually diagnosed as prion disease, a rare and fatal brain disorder. The fight not only challenged the family's emotional resilience, but led to a huge transformative career change for Sonia and her husband, Eric. I'm Kimmy Culp, and this is All the Wiser, a show about hope and possibility on the other side of pain. And today, about love and legacy in the face of the unknown.
My mom was just she was a gentle person. She had this beautiful artistic streak, and she used to do charcoal sketches of my friends and I when we were kids. I still have one in my bedroom. I was probably about 8. And she had this talent for capturing likeness. She had that gift. She loved to cook. And, you know, my dad was sort of a small town doctor in the old-fashioned mode. It felt like everybody in town had been like his patient or his, you know, their spouse or their sister or their brother or kid had been his patient. So he sort of had that like small town status of knowing everybody.
Sonia grew up in Western Pennsylvania. Her parents had emigrated from India and moved to a small town with not so many other Indians around. She was a quiet kid, loved to read, yet blossomed into more of a social creature with the loving guidance of her parents.
My mom was home and loved to take care, I think, in this very like kind of full way. She cooked beautiful Indian food, and I would try to learn from her, and it wasn't easy because, you know, it was all just intuition. And she used to do these little things like we had for a while placemats that I can still picture where she had painted little embellishments on them to match the wallpaper. Like she took a lot of aesthetic pleasure in caring for the home, caring for her family. Hosting was a big thing in my childhood. We would like fill the house with people. Relatives would come and, you know, nobody was close, but people would come and they would stay for months or, you know, a relative who was just immigrating would live with us for a couple years. So the house had very like porous boundaries in this really lovely way. And she was a great facilitator of that.
Wow. She sounds incredible. What a beautiful illustration. And clearly as an artist, but really creating art within the home and experience and small moments and on the placemat. I mean, that's so beautiful. I can see her. Thank you. What happens next for you, going to college and your dreams and aspirations as a young woman?
Yeah. I went to Swarthmore College near Philadelphia, and I had a million interests and things I wanted to do. But I majored in English and I minored in psychology, and I graduated and moved out to California and got a job in publishing. So I thought that was my sort of like first step into the professional world, which I guess it was. But really what that chapter was for is that that's where I met Eric. I had moved out to Berkeley. I was living there with college friends. Eric and I happened to meet at a dinner party. This was only 3 months after I arrived. And it was an immediate click as a friendship, which then became kind of this intense, exciting, monogamous friendship, which then became this fabulous romance. And we were out there for 2 years and were kind of feeling our way forwards as young adults, and kind of came simultaneously to the decision that it was time to try something new. And I applied to law school. He applied to city planning school. And in the way of that, you know, that special place and that special time in our lives, we were at first determined to stay in the Bay Area. We had this beautiful family of friends and just felt like it was our place. And of course, life has other plans for you.
Sonia and Eric visited schools in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is where they ultimately decided to pursue their degrees and careers. They were young and very much in love, living in Boston. And then Sonia's mom got sick.
So this actually, I was still in law school. Eric had graduated. My mom was still in Western Pennsylvania, where I grew up. So everything that I had sort of a daily or weekly access to from home was over the phone. I wasn't there in person to see everything at that granularity. I think there's also a degree to which we try to minimize things that are like minor concerns or minor annoyances, especially as maybe parents talking to your kids who are in a different city. I know in my family, I think it's just a common trope, right? You don't want to worry each other. So for everybody, it was murky, because my mom's first symptoms were not a big deal. At least it didn't seem like it. She had lost a bunch of weight, which she couldn't quite explain, and her eyesight was blurry. These were the first things I heard about. So she went to an ophthalmologist. I think she had a conversation with her PCP, but these didn't seem like huge health concerns, and they didn't seem related.
She was 51 at the time, is that right? And healthy, right?
Yes. Yeah. And I mean, I say healthy, you know, with big generous boundaries around that, because I think that's reality, right? Like, I think in medicine, often what we hear is this sort of kind of a model of detraction, mm-hmm. where we like assume 100%,
yeah.
and everything yeah. that comes up is a subtraction from the 100.
Yeah.
But I think the reality of living in a human body is that it's dynamic and it's changing all the time, and it's doing a lot of things that you don't really have access to. And so I would say my mom was healthy. And also, winter in Western Pennsylvania is very, very gray, and it was never her best time. So to hear like, oh, like mom is losing weight, mom's eyesight is a little off this winter, I don't know. It seemed within the bounds of the sorts of fluctuations that can make up a healthy life. It was the next things, I guess, that flowed from that and fairly rapidly that became really, really concerning. And it was like March, I think, of 2010, when I first became aware that the way she was talking was changing. There was a new sort of vagueness and confusion in the way that she talked. A moment that stands out really clearly for me is that March 17th was her birthday, and I called her on March 17th to wish her a happy birthday. And the sentences that she was trying to put together would sort of start out strong, like she knew what she wanted to say, and then they would just drift off, like they didn't have enough momentum to get to the end. It wasn't a thing I'd ever been exposed to before. So now I have some awareness that this is not unheard of in early dementia. But at the time, I just knew it didn't sound like my mom. And I would kind of try to push and draw her back and it would happen again, that her thoughts didn't have the discipline to sort of flow one to the next in a logical way. And my heart just sank. That was the first moment when it was clear to me that something was really wrong. And I hung up the phone, and Eric already knew that something was really wrong.
Just from the look on your face, or?
I think from the look on my face, from what he'd been able to hear of my end of the conversation, there was a real heaviness that came in then.
When the progression is, it's unbelievable, the pace, and yeah.
That spring, in May, I was home, and you couldn't look at her and miss the fact that this person was gravely ill. She had lost so much weight that there was something kind of skeletal about her face, her body. But even beyond that, you would look in her eyes and there was sort of this wild, lost quality. You would talk to her, and at this point, the lucid moments were farther and farther between. A lot of what came out didn't make sense, but it would have like this franticness and this urgency to it. She had lost too much muscle to be able to support herself and walk safely. But as someone who is used to being capable and moving around the world independently, she would try to do that and she would fall and she would hit her head and she would be too confused to be able to tell you, does that hurt? Does it still hurt? If she couldn't tell you if the fall was a big deal, well, then we had to go to the hospital and there would be another CAT scan. And the things, just the number of things that you need to be aware of when a person can't report to you, when they can't self-report what is their state, it was a completely new, horrifying experience for me.
How did you, as a family, how are you managing her care, which is...
Yeah.
It, which is 24 hours, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, she had gone from being an independent adult to being someone who required continuous 24-hour-a-day care in a matter of weeks. And how to manage it was a complete mystery, in part because we didn't know what was going on. And at this point, she was being taken to neurologists, and they were drawing blood, and they were drawing spinal fluid, and they were doing imaging. But we had no answers from that and no idea what was happening. So whether this was the next couple weeks of our life or the next 20 years of our life was not clear. Therefore, making sort of an operating plan, there was just a tremendous amount of uncertainty and guesswork. And my suggestions that I should come home, because obviously this was a crisis, it was a debate with my dad, who, for whom I think maintaining some semblance of normalcy in my life was a priority. And he also debated, you know, with himself and with me, what does it make sense to do in terms of my work schedule? But you can't put things on hold for 20 years the way you can if you know that this is a problem that needs to be got through, and, you know, we will find the right diagnosis or treatment or, you know, something. So we just had no clues. And so I continued here, but went home when I could. My dad continued working. My mom's mom was living with us at that time, my grandmother. And my dad and my grandmother were splitting the day-to-day caretaking. But it was not really a two-person job. It was a much more than that person job. And I actually think there isn't really an answer out there.
Sonia looked into long-term care for her mom, but full-time nursing would have cost about $400,000 a year. Meanwhile, her mother was so debilitated that even having two full-sized adults trying to bathe her wasn't enough. And hospitals, they learned, are really only set up for short-term problems. They are not willing or able to accommodate anything but acute care.
That's the system we have. So there really was no answer. I think what ended up happening was just that my grandmother and my dad took on much, much more than a person should. And I tried to pitch in and help as I could. And it just ran everybody completely ragged.
There's this I think it's hard. My guess is you're going to say it's very hard to explain, but I hope you can try. And I've talked to people, you know, friends and loved ones who've experienced the complexity of somebody physically being in the world, their body being in the world, yet the person you know is gone. Like this,
yes.
The complexity of the grief and that you've lost the mother you know, but there she is.
Yes.
And I'm curious about that internally, but I heard you mentioned in another interview, which I've never heard anyone talk about, is that as community, as people who we know what to say when somebody loses a parent, but
yes.
But these sort of micro losses, or it almost seems like a million little deaths. If
yes.
So I'd love for you to share that piece of it and how you experienced it.
Absolutely. You know, it was years later that I encountered Pauline Boss's work on ambiguous loss, and it spoke to me so clearly. Like that's absolutely what we were experiencing that year. We all had, as you know, as happens in a situation where you have zero information, we all had different ways that we pieced together the little we could see. We all had different expectations. I think that for my dad, who dealt with very sick patients professionally, by summer, I think, despite not having a diagnosis, he could begin to see that she was very, very, very sick, the kind of sick where even having a diagnosis at that time, even having some treatment at that time, we would be asking her to climb maybe an insurmountable mountain back into her life. And I think it was that summer that I was coming to understand that as well. But into the fall, I remember being home in October, and there was a beautiful public park across the street from my parents' home. And I went walking there. The fall colors in Western Pennsylvania are just the crown jewel of that region. They're just beautiful. And I went for a walk and realized that I was grieving. She was still alive, but I was grieving. And in some ways, I had already said goodbye. We, at that point, I could be physically present. We could be in the same place. I no longer had the sensation that we were able to look at each other. Her eyes darted, and I don't know if she saw me. She looked terrified all the time. I fear that her experience of the world by that point, because now she was in sort of a series of hospitalizations and constantly being sort of sent from place to place, but sort of continuously hospitalized. And I fear that her experience of the world was pain, and that was the main thing she was able to still experience at that point, because when anyone would draw near her bed, she would flinch and she would withdraw. And she was being stuck with needles, as we do to people, you know, like umpteen times an hour. And I think this reflex of just drawing away became sort of the last way in which she could interact with the world, which, I don't know, it brings me a ton of pain to this day.
In terms of a timeline, from her first symptoms to the continuous hospitalizations, it was about 3 months. A few months after that, she was unable to interact, recognize, or communicate with her family in any way, still with no diagnosis. There were theories, of course, heavy metal toxicity, autoimmune disease, Lyme disease, yet the whole experience remained a mystery. And it was that, the not knowing, that was taking a toll.
I see it in other families that I know who go through a medical crisis with tremendous unknowns around it. And honestly, a lot of these situations are situations in which, say 50 years ago, but maybe even 15 years ago, the person might have just died. But we have a medical infrastructure that can prolong this moment of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And maybe we call it a moment of hope, but also a moment of great uncertainty. And wow, we've created new limbos. And sometimes we ask people to live there for a very long time. And I don't think that we have an amazing capacity for dialogue around what those limbos feel like, how to exist there, and when staying there is the right thing.
Can you give some language or context to what it means to be in that limbo, that specific?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, for me, and I had this excruciating but also privileged position of not being there on the ground all the time. For me, the limbo was wondering all the time, should I be there? Am I making the right choice? How often can I be back? What more can I do to support my dad and grandma? Increasingly, my focus was on the long-term toll on them. And, you know, I say long-term, this all took place within the space of a calendar year, but it is remarkable. It is like mind-blowing how much a person can age in the space of a year like this. I felt that both of them, the toll was unbelievable.
She eventually was on life support, is that right?
Yeah.
So eventually you take her off life support and she passes away.
Yes.
At what point do you have a definitive diagnosis? Well, first of all, I want to talk about that because I heard you say that her death was oddly the easiest part of that year.
Yeah. It took me a long time to be able to talk about this, but now I feel it's important to talk about it precisely because it's so hard to talk about. It was. Her death was, for me, the easiest part of that whole story. She had been suffering so much, and it had become so hard to see. And I had that very strong sense that she had already taken these big, big steps out of her life, out of life, that were becoming harder and harder to imagine her retracing, no matter what information came to us. It felt like it would be cruel to ask her to try to come back towards health.
I would also imagine it for anybody in this or any family in a similar situation, when you explain the year, what that looked like on every level, emotionally, physically, logistically, all of it.
Yep.
You know, for your dad, for your grandma, for you, for your mom, the exhaustion and the toll on that many levels that there is would be a relief, right? For I would imagine you experiencing an alleviation, certainly of your mother's suffering, but not only that, your father's.
Yes.
That perhaps he will sleep through the night, perhaps.
Exactly. You
know, yes, that there—
It did feel unsustainable.
Yeah.
And yet— no one was swooping in to say, here's the way this works. Here's the way this situation becomes bearable. But there was only us, right, trying to like cobble forward a path. And yes, I worried constantly about his exhaustion and my grandmother's too. And I think you go into this kind of medical limbo and it pulls you away from everything that would ordinarily sustain you. You have no time. You have no time. You have no energy to see your friends or, you know, step outside of it and do whatever it is that usually brings you like just a moment of like respite and joy. It's so all consuming.
Yeah. All the little and the big things that fill you up and give you vitality. There's no time, no space for it, right?
Yes, exactly. There are no boundaries, you know, around what this experience takes from you. It just takes everything.
So your mom passes away, and at what point did your dad decide? Did you know that he decided to do an autopsy for some definitive answers?
I did. I knew that was something that he sort of assumed would happen, in the interest of just closure and understanding.
Because it's still a mystery when there was no definitive
exactly.
diagnosis. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. She dies and it's still a mystery.
Well, tell me about the funeral and the celebration of your mom's life, if you can, just provide a little color
sure.
to it. We talk so much about the pain and suffering of the year leading up to it.
Yeah. It was local, and I think somewhere on the order of 300 people showed up. And I remember standing there and shaking people's hands and just being so grateful that people were there. Like every person, people who I knew well and had known for years, people who I just recognized, colleagues of my dad's, people who I'd known in grade school, like it had been such a lonely year. And I felt like I was returning from another planet, being able to look into these people's faces, face after face, and shake their hands.
Yeah, it's so interesting. You just touched on the loneliness aspect and the juxtaposition of that now so public facing, right? Literally back into your community, eye to eye with hundreds of people.
Yeah.
So your mom has passed and you have the services. At what point do you learn definitively what she had died from? And tell me about that conversation with your dad when you learned the news.
Sure. So I knew, you know, somewhere in the back of my mind that the autopsy was sort of pending, that it was going to happen. And it was October of that year that I was home for the engagement party of my oldest childhood friend. Eric and I were both there. And we went to the party, and my dad was there, and many, many people who I grew up with were there. And it was beautiful. And the next evening, Sunday evening, we were preparing to fly back to Boston. And my dad sort of took me aside and said, "We have to talk about something. It's about Mom." And that was all he had to say, actually, for me to know that something absolutely momentous and incredibly ominous was like in the air between us, that it was about to be said, and that things would be different. But you can know all that and still have no idea. Like I didn't know what he was going to say. And what he said was, "It's about Mom's disease. It was genetic." I asked him questions. I remember asking him, "Is it dominant or recessive?" And he said, "I don't know," which in retrospect, I don't believe. He was a doctor, and I think he knew. I also think he couldn't talk about it. I think there was only, like, he had already done maybe the hardest thing he'd ever had to do in telling me. And there was so far he could push himself. And then it was with me, this information, and it was on me to tell Eric, which was in turn the hardest thing I've ever had to do. This was all happening just as we were sort of having to leave for the airport. So we did that. The whole drive, I didn't talk about this. And he knew as we were driving to the airport that something was really, really wrong. And it was on the plane that I told him. And yeah, I think the sensation, even as my dad had told me when we were sitting in my childhood home, had been that kind of the floor was opening up and I was falling. And that is also how it felt on the plane. So maybe that was like the wrong place to tell him. But yeah, it was one of these moments of sort of total psychological tailspin where something's going to happen next. You know that. But you really, really don't know what it's going to be.
So now you have a choice to make, a decision.
Yes.
To pursue testing and more information. And, you know, I think you mentioned that people would say, you know, ignorance is bliss, and you would say limbo is torture.
Yeah.
You know, all of these, this big weighty decision. Did you know immediately that you would be tested, or did coming to that decision take time for you?
You know, I knew right away, and so did Eric. We both knew right away. It only became more clear to me as we like trudged through the limbo in pursuit of genetic testing. And that took weeks of advocating and fighting, honestly, for the ability to access that information. But no, I knew right away. On the one hand, my feeling on the argument that ignorance is bliss is that I was no longer in a place of ignorance and that wasn't mine to choose. I knew my risk.
Yeah.
And that idea that making the choice to stay in limbo means you're kind of frozen, at least for me. You're kind of like choosing to take this particular moment and just like dilate it and stay in it. And it's a very painful one. whereas the knowing, which could go either way, right? We were up against 50-50 odds, to me, had the quality of moving forward. Like, be it like a good or a bad outcome, I knew that I didn't want to get stuck in this moment.
Yes, and from having been so void of information in the midst of pain and suffering, yeah.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Like we had just had the front row seats to what is it like to operate in total uncertainty.
Yeah.
And like, gosh, there were, if I had to put a rationale around it, there are lots I could give. I could say, I would never want loved ones of mine to be as confused about what was happening to me as we were about what was happening to my mom. I could also say there was a 50% chance that I would be able to release Eric and my dad from worrying about this on my account.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those were all in there, but like really, it was a gut feeling. It was just like a gut knowledge of self.
As it turns out, it is not so easy to get your own genetic testing done. It takes a lot of time and effort, hours and hours spent advocating for yourself just to get approved and move forward. So once Sonia finally completed the testing, it still took 2 agonizing months to get the results. Coming up, the results of the test, and so much more. Back after a quick break. All the Wiser is a one-for-one podcast. For every story you hear, we donate $2,000 to our guest's favorite charity. Sonia chose the Prion Alliance. Prion Alliance is a nonprofit devoted exclusively to advancing scientific research towards a treatment or cure for human prion disease. You can learn more about their work at prionalliance.org. That's prionalliance.org. How was the information relayed to you, and what was your experience of hearing it or receiving it?
Yeah. Well, the words that were said to me, it was phrased very conservatively. The words were, the same change that was found in your mother was found in you. I will say that beforehand, before the big reveal, I'd been told that, you know, no matter what the results are, we will sit together and we will make a care plan and we will digest and process. Then the results were given to me. And then the professionals said, you must want some time, and left the room and didn't come back. Oh,
ever?
So, yeah, no, ever. So Eric and I were there, and, you know, my full attention was on him. I thought, he needs me. And this is the person I've come to recognize as my, like, kind of crisis self. She's very calm and sensitive to who is most in need. And it was Eric. Eric was most in need. So I held him for a while. And we had also been advised, and it was really good advice, to bring a couple of people who were close with us to the appointment. So we had 2 close friends sitting in the waiting room. And eventually, we decided we were ready to go out and be with them. And I called my dad, who had not flown in for the appointment. I think that he really needed to believe that there wasn't going to be a need. But I called him and told him, and he came in that evening. And we ended up, the 5 of us spent the weekend together, just very quietly, doing normal things. We went out to eat that evening.
And it's so interesting because it's this, as you said, this big reveal, and you don't know the language you would use, but really, you know, earth-shattering in a way, yet everything is the same. Nothing acutely changes.
Exactly.
So yeah, how did you begin to think about your life differently?
Yeah, that was the initial balance to regain, thinking through the fact that, yes, this is a big piece of information now made known to me. On the other hand, this information has been in every cell of my body my whole life, and I'm no more likely to die tomorrow than I already was. Like, this information now being in the conscious part of my brain doesn't make it more likely than it already always was.
Yeah, the truth is the truth, right?
Yes,
your body
exactly.
hasn't changed. Yeah.
Exactly.
So explain what, for people who are listening, obviously are not going to have the information on prion or what that piece of information means, sort of in layman terms, about
sure.
your future, you know, inherent risk and your timeline. So there's no confusion there.
Prion disease, not all of which is genetic. And prion disease, you know, as we saw with my mom, it's this rapidly progressive neurodegenerative disease. It kills about 1 in 6,000 people, which, you know, is not ultra, ultra rare. Genetic cases are maybe 10 to 15% of those cases. And in a genetic case, it is autosomal dominant. So you have a parent who has a mutant copy of the gene, and each kid has a 50% chance of inheriting it. Maybe yes, maybe no. But what it means to have that sort of risk variant is different than in many diseases, in the sense that you remain perfectly healthy for a variable number of decades. And then at some point, and we cannot predict when, you become symptomatic. And then from that point to death, as we saw with my mom, it is not uncommon to hear, you know, 6 months, 5 months. It is not uncommon to hear that it was a certain number of weeks. So it's kind of unusual kinetics. When we picture neurodegenerative disease, when we picture something like Alzheimer's, we picture a very gradual progression, maybe 10, maybe 20 years of things that are going wrong molecularly, and then symptoms over many years, and then this sort of long decline. And in prion disease, it's really just a lightning strike, how rapid it is.
And is it definitive with the mutation that you will, in fact, at some point in your life, the progression will begin?
I always hesitate to say.
You know the question I'm
trying to ask. I mean, it's absolutely. It's an important question.
Yeah.
And it's actually one of the first questions that we tried to get a better answer to when we became scientists. I think at this point, we can say that not every mutation in the prion protein gene is created equal. Some are benign. Some are risk factors. But there are some that are what we would call Mendelian, in the sense that if you have that variant, you have a very high probability of developing the disease at some point in your life. Mine is one of those. And it's always hard to put exact quantitative estimates on these things, especially where the age of onset is very wide. And with genetic prion disease, the age of onset is very wide. So you will have people who live into later decades of life. Maybe they would have developed genetic prion disease if they had lived longer.
Yeah.
But we can say, I think, 90% plus odds of developing and dying of the disease.
Got it. How did you start to think about your life differently? Or were there behavioral changes? I mean, I'm so curious about how this information begins to transform the way you think about your life and your time here.
Yeah. I would say in those first couple of weeks, there was like a tentativeness to everything that I would have to talk myself down from by reminding myself that even though I had this, you know, disease-causing mutation, I still wasn't likely to die the next day or within the next week. And then I would sort of get up the next day and tell myself the same thing. And that's true. And that created sort of this like sliding bubble around me where I could sort of look forward by small increments of time and say, you know, it's really not likely to change my life over this time scale. So that's how I first got my balance. And then quite rapidly, a thing happened that took us to a new place of finding our balance, which is that a scientist friend came over and brought some scientific articles on a thumb drive and said, science has answers for you. You guys should read these.
Science has answers for you. Those words were the seeds that Sonia and Eric didn't even know they were looking for. She had a law degree, Eric a transportation engineering degree. They were not people with scientific training. In fact, that thumb drive sat there in their house for a few days before they even opened it. But once they did, that research became a sort of portal that would take them into an entirely new phase of their lives.
It was immediately apparent, right? Not a lot was immediately apparent from those articles. They were like chock-a-block full of jargon, and we were not trained to read that jargon. However, what was apparent was that there were people working on prion disease as their full-time job in the research world. And if you'd asked me whether that was the case during the year of my mom's illness, I think I would have said no. It just seemed like nobody knew anything about whatever disease this was. And we were just so traumatized from that experience of her hospitalization that it was not clear to me that what we can offer people clinically is a very different picture than what people are doing and imagining on the research side.
This would be the beginning of a professional change and the career trajectories and work for both you and Eric.
Yep.
Talk about the evolution of those changes and how things unfolded.
Sure. I think that things proceeded in sort of this like organic and stepwise way, guided by the fact that our brains wanted to be doing something. And the available options, like obsessing over our bad fortune or reliving my mom's illness, the available options didn't resonate with us. But in this sort of like sudden incursion of sort of like science into the conversation, I think we sensed a way to engage with our new situation and the new information that we had that worked for us, that actually seemed like a source of light and energy. And we sort of gravitated towards it. This took the form of, you know, trying to read more. And the tools at first were super humble. It was the stuff you can Google. It was, you know, trying to figure out what are prions and what do we know and who are the people who are working on this and what do they think. And we started convening some of our scientist friends once a week at our apartment, and we had a science night, and they would teach us how to think about some of the things we were trying to read, which was, you know, completely non-trivial. But they could talk us through, like, when you see these terms, here's what you should picture. Here's what's going on inside the cell. And I remember a moment when a friend of mine from college and a friend of Eric's, actually also from college, who did not know each other, but were both, she was trained as a biologist and he was trained as sort of a chemist and material scientist. And they were both over at our apartment, and they were able to sort of collaborate extemporaneously to describe to us the secretory pathway by which proteins made inside the cell travel to either the surface or to be exported from the cell. And the fact that they could improvise together, despite being strangers to each other, was really beautiful. It gave me a sense of energy around what it might be possible to learn.
But that eventual, which is your work today, your collaboration on a daily basis with Eric and understanding prion and prevention and treatment, and how do you go from, you know, law school, urban, how do you make that career change?
Yeah. The first thing that happened was that I had to acknowledge to myself that I was being pulled to learn more about this. And what I said to myself at the time was, you know, this is where my mind wants to be. And maybe what I need is a sabbatical from my regular life, because this is a lot to take in. I'll take some time to learn about it, and then I'll come back. And when I initially left my job, it was sort of with that framework and the idea that I just needed to invest some time in getting oriented. And, you know, part of the impetus was feeling like we can't count on other people. We can't count on like a doctor to know if something happens in the space of this rare disease, because we saw what my mom went through, and it felt that we would really have to be our own advocates, and we would have to have our own eye on this problem over time. So I shifted to structuring my own time. I took this huge leap. I quit my job, and I would read papers, and I would go to classes around town. I enrolled in night classes. Eric stayed in his job, but also enrolled in night classes. And we had these science nights. We called researchers on the phone to see who would talk with us. And we started to knit together the most rudimentary vocabulary around this disease. It wasn't very long. Gosh, I left my job in January. We enrolled in night classes that semester. And in March, I was staying after a lab for my night class in molecular biology and talking to the TA who runs the lab at Mass General Hospital. And he was interested in why I was enrolling in the class. And I told him sort of all the circumstances that had led to me being there. And I asked him, do you know of a lab where I could volunteer? Because I'm trying to read about all of these different techniques that we can use to sort of look at the biology of this disease. And a lot of them don't mean anything to me at all. I had not taken a biology course since my sophomore year of college. And he said, let me look into it and get back to you. And within a couple of days, had sent me a job opening for a lab in his department that was looking for a full-time technician. And his advice was, explain your motivation. Tell them that you don't have experience, but you are highly motivated to learn. Apply for the job. So I did. And I got the job. And that, you know, marked another big shift where I was in a lab all day and I was coming home so energized. And also, honestly, I think from the moment of quitting my previous job, there was something very freeing in this whole chapter of our life about like having our backs against the wall and no longer feeling constrained by having to make sense. You know, things were sort of like making their own sense. And I felt like that was good enough for me. Like, you know, all of this like thinking and overthinking about like your path and your career and your this and your that, and what are you going to do with your like one precious life? Like,
it became so clear, right?
Suddenly, yeah. Like,
yeah.
But it was simultaneously clear, like on some emotional level, I felt pulled towards certain things and taking certain risks. And also on the more like the level of sort of like CV narration, where we usually meet people professionally, it wasn't at all clear, right? It didn't make sense with anything I'd done before. And it was almost hard to explain, even to the people who were closest to at the time, why we needed to make big changes all of a sudden. I think, you know, for my dad, it was a little unsettling. You just went through a lot. Like, are you sure that you want to like make all these changes? And are you sure you want to be thinking about this disease all day? And like, why don't you take a while and, you know, think about it and sit on it and wait and see if this like, wait for the like the most acute wave of processing to pass. And I understand where all of this, you know, well-intentioned advice was coming from. And at the same time, I think there was like sort of a primal thing that was happening where my brain wanted to do something. And here was the productive thing it could do. Here was the thing that wasn't spinning my wheels or digging deeper into, you know, the negative emotions. Here was the thing that felt positive. And I just had to go with it.
Sonia was off and running in her new job. And then, a few months later, Eric also made a change. He went from data analysis and transportation to data analysis and biology, also at Mass General Hospital. And remember, those first jobs in science came only a few months out from the most terrible news ever for Sonia and Eric. Yet both of them couldn't believe the energy and excitement they felt. They were learning new things, meeting new people, having interesting conversations, plus making enough money to live. At this point, there was no going back.
Neither of us were working on prion disease in those first jobs in science. We were just sort of learning the ropes. We were learning skill sets and applying them to other diseases. We did that for about 2 years, and then it was time to make the next pivot. We'd started a nonprofit, Prion Alliance, and one idea was we raise money through Prion Alliance as our full-time job, and we fund people to do research. People advised us to start a biotech. I was like, around what, right? We need like the thing. We need the idea. And the landscape is different in every disease, in every rare disease, especially in terms of what you have and what you lack and where two highly motivated people can plug in and sort of make the most difference. In prion disease, what we looked around and saw was that we know quite a bit, right? Not everything, never everything, but we know quite a bit about the basic biology of prion disease. We looked at the landscape and said, we have enough bricks. We need to go stand on the wall. We need to try to take what's known, incomplete as it necessarily is, like figure out how can we channel that towards a therapy because we think it's enough. So that became the sort of next chapter of the mission. And we took another huge risk in applying to graduate school, thinking probably the right place for that mission is academia. But it's just incredibly unusual for two people to show up as entering PhD students and be like a husband-wife team with their own mission that they are like devoted to from day one. And finding the right place to pursue this like this work was, we took a huge leap of faith that we would find it. I think we were just unbelievably lucky to find the people who were going to be our mentors here at the Broad. And in 2014, we enrolled in a PhD program based at Harvard, and we joined Stuart Schreiber's lab here at the Broad Institute. And he and Eric Lander really became our advisors who bet on us from day one to work on prion disease, even though no one at the Broad had worked on neurodegenerative disease prior. So we came in and, you know, we sort of brainstormed how to set up a prion program basically from scratch. And we've been here ever since.
Yeah, it's an incredible story that you know, in partnership, what you guys are doing, the work you're doing, and the progress you're making. Obviously, we're talking about a genetic disease, and you and Eric, among many other big decisions and projects you took on, you know, pursued your dream of becoming parents and taking on all it means to become a family and to raise kids.
Yeah, this is another thing that I think was in the sort of like cocktail of subconscious rationales for pursuing genetic testing, although really it was something larger than any one reason. But I was aware that if you carry sort of like single gene variant that causes fatal genetic disease, you can try to do IVF with pre-implantation genetic testing. And from the moment of getting my test result, I think Eric and I had that in mind as the way we hoped to grow our family. We had wanted kids, and I think we both felt strongly that we didn't want to have a moment with our kids in the future like the one my dad had had to have with me. We didn't want to have to break them terrible news about their own risk. And for us, creating the embryos wasn't so hard. I will say, though, that the math of IVF was something other than what I'd pictured. It's just attrition. It's so much attrition. And I'd imagined that we would lose 50% of the embryos when we tested. We would learn that 50% had the mutation. Anyway, we were very, very lucky to end up with healthy embryos. And it took many cycles to have a successful transfer. Nevertheless, it was 2017 when our daughter was born. And in 2020, we had our son. And nothing is guaranteed, right, in life or in biology. But I think we have as much reasonable confidence as we can have that they did not inherit my genetic prion disease mutation or my risk.
And I would imagine becoming a mother yourself, and as you get older, closer to the age that your mother was, I think becoming a mother makes you, or at least provides the opportunity for you to experience your mother in a whole new way, if that makes sense. So,
yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, I'm just curious how motherhood has changed your relationship to your mom and her loss.
I mean, parenthood has been a new chapter in my relationship with my mom. And, you know, it's amazing to me the way these relationships not only keep going, but keep getting richer, like keep evolving, even after a loved one passes. I feel very close to her in certain experiences of parenting. I see her differently. I see her side of that dance, what she gave, what she gave up, what she fought to keep alive. And I wish we could talk about it. The sense in which my mom is with me now, it's interesting. I have this very, very strong sense of her still being in my life as a person who is both simultaneously herself and has an equanimity and perspective that, you know, like we're all human. It wasn't always available to my mom in her life. But yeah, I have to imagine that on some level, we're getting to have that conversation.
I'm also curious about your relationship to time as it pertains to, which is a dance with all of us, the past,
yes,
the present and the future, but how much prion in particular and the uncertainty around that, how much are you, especially because, you know, as a patient scientist, right, driven by your own story, how much do you dance with the future and the fear versus being able to fully be in the present? What does that look like for you?
Sure. I think I must have made a decision early on, although it wasn't conscious, that I could spend a lot of energy, potentially an unbounded amount of energy, anticipating worst-case scenarios and early onsets for myself, and that might indeed be what happened, but that I would more productively channel myself in all ways, like into our work, but also into our life, if I held that space open and didn't particularly fixate on dying anytime soon. I think, you know, to sort of set up our scientific enterprise, we had to have some amount of faith in the medium term. And that is a leap of faith, but we decided to take it because I think that was the path that we saw to making progress. I see, you know, both in our work and in parenting, the way in which when I talk about the future, it's with a certain amount of like respect for the uncertainty. Like as you said, that's actually an uncertainty that we all live with.
Yeah.
But we have all these patterns of speech and thought that would try to disregard it. And I'm very like attentive to ways of talking casually about a presumed future. And this comes up so much with parenting, right? You assume that X, Y, and Z are going to happen over the next like 5, 10, 18, 25 years. I'm observant of that. I see why, right? Where it's just like a common vernacular. But I also try to meter out for myself, what would this mean for me in a certain amount of time? But what does it mean for me now? What's the best way for us to be together and in each other's lives now? And I think there's a way in which that can sound morbid, but I think for me, it's been really helpful. You know, I turned 40 in 8 days, and it's been a real point of reflection. I feel like I've been coming up on it and living into it for a while. It's silly. If we counted our lives in days, it wouldn't be a day of particular note, but I do feel that I'm coming into the life phase, and I feel it with mothering, and I feel it with this birthday, that I'm coming into the life phase roughly that my mom was when I last knew her and when she got sick. And there's some paradox in there that's kind of at the heart of what we do. On the one hand, there's a certain impatience, that a useful impatience that I get from thinking about the years it takes to do this work, thinking about how much we need, not just for me, but for the people in our community who are in my position, to move faster, knowing that we need to move as directly as we can to useful drugs. The paradox is in how that relates to being able to give ourselves a certain amount of grace around the things we can't control. Like, both are true. Somehow they're true together. We've put a lot into motion, and I feel really optimistic in the longer term about moving towards therapies for prion disease. Again, no certainties in biology, but I really do feel optimistic that we happened upon this problem at the right moment, when we're sort of in this like beautiful biotechnological moment, when new tools are appearing on Earth that can be usefully applied to this problem. And we came along as matchmakers and are so fortunate to be networked to mentors and collaborators who can help us matchmake between this disease and those technologies. A lot is possible. It's also the case that we have no guarantees. And it is also the case that while mysteries remain and while there are no certainties in biology, I think we have some of the sort of scientific puzzle pieces aligned in a useful way. So we've just got to push.
Hi, listeners. My conversation with Sonia is our 99th full-length interview. All the Wiser is ending next month with our 100th episode. We have a little dream in ending the show with you. We want to know how All the Wiser has made a change in the world, whether that's in small ways or big, a favorite episode, favorite guest, a piece of wisdom, knowledge that's impacted you. Our hope is to read your words and hear your voices in this last month of the show. And we will even be sharing some on our finale episode. You can give us that little gift one of two ways. DM us on Instagram at All the Wiser Podcast, or better yet, call our voicemail line. It's 310-243-6364. That's 310-243-6364. And if you're driving or on the go, the number and handle are in our show notes. Thank you for being a part of this journey. It continues to be an honor and a privilege. How does your mom show up for you today?
You know, it's funny that you ask. I have felt that in the run-up to turning 40, certain things have come back into my life and like announced themselves as important to me. You know, we've got this like medium intensity day job or whatever. We've got these kids who are super demanding right now. They're 6.5 and 4. Nevertheless, I've suddenly found that I need to make time for art. And I think that's her. I think it's her. It's hard to describe, but it's a pull. It's a pull of my energy, like magnetically in a certain direction, just as I felt when we were getting into science. Like I was pulled into this profession, and now I'm being pulled to find what time I can to honor her by making art.
When you share your story, or like you are right now with me, and people all around the world will eventually hear your story and your words and your message, what is your hope? What do you hope people take away from your story? And yeah, just what you've been through with the loss of your mom and the realization of Prion in your life.
Well, I'm glad you asked. There's a way in which Eric and I have been crystal clear on our mission from day one, right? We had this North Star, and the North Star was a treatment for prion disease, and it hasn't gone away. At the same time, what that means to us has evolved really richly in the years that we've been at this. One thing that I've come to see as absolutely central to what we're trying to do is prevention. Clinical trials are almost always done in sick patients, right? Every disease is different. There are circumstances where that makes sense and where that can be practically done. Then I look at prion disease and I think about that lightning strike. And I think about what it would mean for us to do this work for 10 or 20 years, only to find that we are having to wait until I get sick and I'm already losing my words, my ability to recognize Eric and my kids, my ability to do the things that bring me joy. I'm already losing them, and I'm losing them at lightning pace. And then we go into my body with the drug and we try to outrun an exponential process that is already underway. This has become like one of the core tragedies of drug development for me. You know, we create systems, and I think our typical system for doing clinical trials is not a good fit for prion disease. Now, there are people who we will not know. With current technology, we will not have the opportunity to know that they're at risk for prion disease before they get sick. In those cases, we need really aggressive early diagnosis. And there are people who are working on this, and we have much better tools now than we did when my mom was sick. Thank goodness. But in cases where we have, like I do, information ahead of time, it is just too heartbreaking that we would consider sitting on that information until a person is losing the things that matter most to them. It's a mandate to preserve. It's a mandate to prevent. And that means that we have to be willing to talk about taking experimental therapies into people who have a letter from the future, they have high genetic risk, and they're currently healthy. And our goal is to keep them that way. You know, I'm standing here as one of those people telling you that dependent on the details, that is a risk that we need to be willing to talk about and that I would be willing to take.
That makes so much sense to me. And the letter from the future is beautiful, beautifully put. Yeah, getting comfortable with that risk and putting systems to support taking that risk.
Yes. And really asking, whose risk is it to take? Everybody thinks differently about what risks are worth it to them. But this is intimate stuff. This is personal stuff. And these are areas where we need to respect, like when we're up against the guarantee almost, like at the point where someone is symptomatic, it is today a guarantee that they will die of this disease. And to carry a mutation like mine and to have watched, you know, in my case, my mom, in some people's cases, generations of their family die of this disease, we can't project ourselves into someone else's mind and kind of, you know, systematize what is and isn't worth it to them.
We are a show about hope and possibility on the other side and really through pain. What is bringing you hope? What are you hopeful for?
You know, I have a couple answers. One answer is that kids are just an incredible source of forward momentum. But professionally, I don't have to look very far for sources of hope because there's so much to do. And we're so far from the end of this quest, but we're also so far from the beginning. And I wouldn't have known if you had told me when I was, you know, receiving my genetic test report in 2011, and when we were going through the process of deciding to change careers in 2012, and you'd said, make a wish for where this change in careers will take you. I would not have had the creativity or imagination to pray for what we have now. And really, what does that stand on? What does all of that stand on? It stands on people having taken a risk on us, seeing our mission and our commitment to it, deciding that we were serious even before we could demonstrate that. I've never regretted leading with my story. And I think through that, we've really had the opportunity to see the best in people. Not everybody would respond that way, but you know what? We meet the people who do. We meet the people who want to help. And, you know, we're building a small army of them. And it's been a beautiful experience. I hope that the army, you know, I hope it'll be enough. I hope we'll do it. I hope we'll do it in time. I hope for all those things. But already it's this like tremendous affirmation for me of the good that is out there.
I love that. And thank you for showing up and for sharing yourself and your mom and your story with me. And you both have inspired me to make more time for art in my own life. So thank you for that reminder as well.
I'm so happy to hear that.
All right. Thank you again and be well.
You too, Kimmy. Thank you.
I hope you're as moved by Sonia's courage and tenacity as I am. And now that you've absorbed the gravity and inspiration of her story, why keep it to yourself? Spark a conversation with friends and family about genetic heritage, the impact of science in our own lives, and the universal experience of grief and healing. And remember to listen to life's callings. Sometimes they lead you down a path you never expected, but to exactly where you were meant to be.
Thank you for listening to this, the 99th episode of All the Wiser. And thank you for listening to the closing credits. That gives me, John LaSala, a chance to tell you that this podcast just couldn't happen without the likes of Erica Gerard and Tara Daigle, our producer and associate producer, respectively. And me? I've been editing the episodes and composing the music for All the Wiser since September of 2022. And I'm proud to be a part of this amazing little team led by your host, Kimmy Culp, who at this point in the podcast traditionally says, take care of yourself and one another.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.